So here we are, spring 2011. We're heading to another summer with soaring gas prices, another series of conflicts in the Middle East choking off our oil supply, more squabbles in Washington over the future of energy independence. This is a familiar and often depressing script, but it doesn't have to be that way. Did you know that in 1900 you could take an electric taxicab across Manhattan? That many Western settlers in the 1890s powered their water pumps by wind turbines, that there was a solar power boom after World War II. Oil hasn't always been king, and in his new book, Alexis Madrigal tries to remind us that green technology is as old as American entrepreneurship itself. And if we know the history of efficient energy, then perhaps we're not doomed to repeat it. Alexis Madrigal, senior technology editor at The Atlantic. And his new book is Powering the Dream, The History and Promise of Green Technology. It's out now from DaCapo Press. Alexis, welcome to WNYC.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
I'm going to hand you a piece of paper.
Okay.
And I want you to describe what you see for our listeners. Do you recognize those faces?
I do. It's a series of U.S. presidents caricatured.
Nixon, Ford, Carter, Reagan, H.W. Bush, Clinton, W. Bush, and Obama. And each of them gets one word in this cartoon, and the total sentence spells out,
"We must reduce our dependency on Mideast oil."
So not to start with the most depressing question first, but as you think about the history of alternative fuel, how much do you keep butting up against political ineffectiveness when every single president says we have to make a change?
Well, I think there's a difference between saying we have to make a change and actually trying to create the institutions and the kind of cultural awareness that would allow you to actually move away from Middle Eastern oil. I also think oil is a great product. I mean, I think as much as I think the environmental movement has not wanted us to think of the kind of wonders of oil, there's so much energy packed into this liquid that's easy to move around. And I think the kind of technical reality of that has been that as much oil that you can get a hold of, you burn.
And we continually see green as this new unexplored area of technology. As I mentioned in the introduction, your book goes back to the 19th century efforts to implement wind and steam and geothermal and solar. And there were some of the examples along the way that I mentioned. Why is it so hard for any of these to really take off in the marketplace?
Well, I think one of the big problems is the price of oil goes up and it goes down, it goes up and it goes down. But the price of the sun is basically about the same. And unfortunately, the kind of machinery you have to put in order to capture solar energy effectively or wind energy effectively, you kind of pay that up front. And I think that has been a kind of key structural problem for the solar industries of all kinds. In that when the price of oil is low, everyone kind of forgets about them and they go bust. And when the price of oil is high, people get reinterested and they boom. And after a while, people start to say, well, hey, what's wrong with the solar industry? They keep, you know, flaming out. And part of the problem is that the government has never provided the kind of long-term support that they did for, say, nuclear power or in the form of various tax incentives for the oil industry.
And I guess there was some point where oil was new. And somebody said, wow, we can just drill this stuff out of the ground and we'll be able to power all our stuff.
Yeah. I mean, there's a great, actually, you know, in Western Pennsylvania is where the first oil boom was, a place actually called Petrolia. And really what people realized, they could pump money out of the ground, right? I mean, imagine you're just sitting on this like two-dimensional piece of land that you're like eking out some terrible existence farming on. And all of a sudden you drill down, you know, a few hundred feet and suddenly the saleable product comes pouring out of the ground. That's pretty difficult to compete with.
Your book has 27 chapters, but in reading it, you get the sense that it could be divided into two sections, before the interstate highway system and after.
Yeah, it's a really good point. I think after the highway system, the history gets really interesting because you have all these developers who essentially moved away from any kind of solar planning system. That is to say, they replaced design of homes that people had long known worked. Like, let's say, if you live in a hot area, having a tree next to your house is actually a form of passive solar. And they completely moved away from those things because they realized that they could get scale moving out farther and farther out into the suburbs and then just, you know, putting the houses down in the kind of ticky-tack form that we know.
Listeners, if you want to call in, we have a few minutes. with Alexis Madrigal, senior technology editor at The Atlantic. His new book is Powering the Dream, The History and Promise of Green Technology. Anything you want to say about what it would take for some alternative fuels to actually break through into being mass fuels? 212-433-9692 or on the history. We looked at the cartoon of the presidents. Here's a montage that The Daily Show put together of presidents referring to new green technology.
Wind turbines. Nuclear energy.
Solar bank.
Energy efficient windows.
Energy efficient homes.
Natural gas. Hydro.
American coal. Solar power.
Ethanol, not just from corn.
Atomic power.
Wood chips and stalks or switchgrass.
Fuel cells.
Natural gas.
Zero emission coal-fired plants.
Solar panels.
Better batteries for hybrid and electric cars.
Methanol.
Ethanol.
Plant products for gasohol.
And you recognize the voices. For some reason, only George W. Bush's reference to switchgrass drew the spontaneous laughter of the audience. Even this year, President Obama talked about solar shingles, which is not a disease, in his State of the Union. But every year there seems to be this parade, not only of the perennials of alternative energy like solar, but all this other stuff that most people have never heard of, and then nothing sticks.
I think the important thing to note from the history is just that the energy system we have is not inevitable. It's not as if we have we get half of our electricity from coal like as a necessary condition of the world. There were a lot of policies. There were a lot of sort of utility imperatives that led to the kind of energy system that we have now. And I think that's what gives me hope about the future, because the sort of social and cultural values that we have help determine the sort of technical reality of the energy system.
And your book is as much about entrepreneurship as it is about environmentalism. And it can't just be the fact that government policy and subsidies favor one kind of energy over another. So how much are green and capitalism compatible at this point, in your opinion?
Well, I think it's been the long dream of green technologists to unite this sort of the idea of progress, the idea that Americans love, whether or not it's a reality that sort of technologies can make the world a much better place, with the ability to preserve the good things about our environment that we want. I mean, I actually have a lot of hope that green technology can be that bridge between capitalism and sort of the other things that we hold dear outside of the monetary system.
In fact, as we do our montage of presidents, even yesterday, President Obama, from his fiscal policy speech, but even though this was about the deficit, look where else he went.
We will make the tough cuts necessary to achieve these savings, including in programs that I care deeply about. But I will not sacrifice the core investments that we need to grow and create jobs. We will invest in medical research. We will invest in clean energy technology. We will invest in new roads and airports and broadband access. We will invest in education. We will invest in job training. We will do what we need to do to compete, and we will win the future.
All right. Now, we're going to put two callers on the air who are calling on related ideas, both from Manhattan, Judy and Mitch. Hi, Judy. Hi, Mitch.
Hi.
Hi there.
Judy, you go first.
I wanted to ask why we aren't developing ocean power, tidal power, as an alternative.
And Mitch?
I'm going to ask the same question, and it has to do directly with the Bay of Fundy project, which Roosevelt had outlined to do, and then World War II came along.
All right. Thank you both. So Judy asked the question. Mitch says there was at least one example in our past.
Right. In fact, there are working tidal power plants in the world. The French have a version of a kind of smaller version of the Bay of Fundy plan. This is some of the most fascinating history has been our attempt to tap ocean power. There are a lot of reasons why it hasn't really worked out, and it's actually some of my most original research came about an 1890s wave motor boom in California. San Francisco and Los Angeles were the home of dozens of innovators and entrepreneurs who were trying to tap ocean power, but it turns out it's harder than it looks. There's always something that goes wrong, and the analogy I like to use is to the kind of Rube Goldberg machines. You know, it just seems like, oh, the ocean waves are coming in, they're so powerful, and if we could just find the right machines of translation, we could turn them into electric power, and all of a sudden they'd light a light bulb, and it's this beautiful sort of analogy for renewable energy thinking, like infinite power source turned into electric light bulb. But it turns out that all those translations, the engineering of those systems, making them robust enough to hold up to storms and all those things, it seems that wave motors, at least up until very, very recently, have tended to sink to the bottom of the ocean.
There does seem to be some recent news about green technology. And let me go through, let me run through a couple of things. Natural gas. This week we saw the first comprehensive study that measured the carbon footprint of natural gas extraction. And it wasn't good news. Turns out it has a huge footprint. And, of course, we in New York have been discussing the effects of the fracking process for a while, that drilling. You blogged this week about a massive solar plant in the Mojave Desert. It's backed in large part by Google, the largest investment Google's ever made in anything, according to what I read. Your book went to press about a month before the earthquake in Japan and the obvious disaster at the nuclear plant there. And yesterday on the show, we did a call-in for people about gasoline prices and how rising prices were changing their behavior. Take a listen to Gennaro from Brooklyn. Here he is, and then I follow up.
Well, I have a pickup truck. I'm a green contractor, and I changed it to vegetable oil.
You can do that?
Yeah. You just change it, and then I pick up my oil from a donut shop, so when I drive, it smells like donuts.
Thank you for your call. I wonder how completely you can switch over. I've heard of it, vegetable oil. That may be for a follow-up Friday segment. We'll look at the vegetable oil fuel. Or for a follow-up Thursday. So, Alexis Madrigal, can you fact-check this for us? Is the donut lobby working heavily to have a million Boston cream-powered pickup trucks on the road?
It's actually not that difficult. There are all kinds of people in San Francisco, where I used to live, who powered their cars with used oil. You can also get biodiesel. In fact, I drove an old biodiesel 80s Mercedes. And you can buy it from a truck that parks behind a co-op grocery store in San Francisco. I think the real question here is, can those things make a difference at sort of the national or global scale? And I think when you look at some of those systems that would allow you or allow, you know, millions of you to be able to drive your car on vegetable oil, it just doesn't get big enough.
And how about that massive investment by Google that you blogged about? I'll bet most of our listeners have not heard about this massive solar plant in the Mojave Desert.
Yes, this is interesting. There's a company called BrightSource that actually formed the core of the last chapter of my book, received $170 million from Google to finish a plant up out in the Mojave Desert. It's actually been disputed by various environmental groups because there are desert tortoises out on the land. And so there's been this battle inside the environmental movement between solar advocates and traditional conservationists. But it's moving forward, and it has, you know, the backing of one of the world's most forward-looking companies, in fact, that laid out the challenge, the energy challenge, is RE less than C. Let's say making renewable energy less than coal is the less expensive than coal. Is a dominant challenge of our day technologically.
Let me run through a handful of callers before we run out of time here who want to make interesting points about the past, present, or future. Fabio in Manhattan, about the past, right?
Yes. I was reading online, apparently Ferdinand Porsche designed a hybrid car in 1901. Originally it was all battery powered, but the batteries were lead batteries and they weighed so much that to save up on the weight, he ended up putting a small engine in it, and the first hybrid vehicle, well, I don't know if it was the first, but 1901.
Thank you very much. Kathy in Brooklyn.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My husband and I were actually just talking about alternative energies last night, and we were wondering if anyone or anybody has taken on lightning.
Lightning as a possible source of energy. John in Woodbridge, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi, thank you. One of the problems we have with petroleum is it does not have to compete with alternative fuels in the transportation sector. And it seems to me that with plug-in hybrids or any plug-in, now you can put coal in your tank, nuclear in your tank, solar in your tank, and now petroleum will have to compete, either innovate or compete on price to remain in that market.
Thank you. One more. Dave in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Dave.
Hi, I just read recently about a man named Scott Brusaw who invented solar panels for paving materials. So it's actually a special glass with a solar panel. And I think about this all the time when I'm driving down the interstate and I see this large median and think, why don't we put solar panels down the medians of our highways? And this gentleman won a GE prize, Eco Imagination Challenge prize, for inventing this solar paving material.
Dave, thank you. Great. So, Alexis, 1901 hybrid Porsche, true fact?
True fact. In fact, the first organized car company in America was right here in Manhattan, the Electric Vehicle Company. I mean, that's an interesting thing. I mean, you really could have called a cab in 1900 to go across New York, and it would have been an electric cab.
What Dave just called about, solar paving?
You know, it's tough. I sort of think we'd rather get it on houses and in traditional solar power plants. But hey, we're going to need it all at some point.
And can we catch lightning in a light switch?
The only place I've ever seen that idea discussed is in a conceptual project by a German artist. But other than that, I haven't seen it out there.
All right. Well, we're just about out of time. This is really good history and kind of reality-based look at the potential for alternative fuels in our future. You know, up next, we're talking about Little House on the Prairie. Do you know if they used windmills on that show?
I don't, but actually, we do know that thousands of people built their own windmills in the 1890s as they came west, found there wasn't enough water, and either took their covered wagons back east with sort of bumper stickers that said, you know, in God we trusted, in Kansas we busted, or they figured out how to create their own windmills out of what they had to hand.
Alexis Madrigal, senior technology editor at The Atlantic. His new book is Powering the Dream, The History and Promise of Green Technology. It's out now from DaCapo Press. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And we finish up today with children's book editor, TV critic, Wendy McClure on her adventures in the lost world of Little House on the Prairie, the TV show, the book, the hidden politics that never quite made it to your screen. Stay with us.